On April 20th, 1999, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold walked into Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, armed with guns and explosives. Over the course of minutes, they would kill 12 students and a teacher. They would wound 24 others before taking their own lives in what was then the worst school shooting in history. For the last 16 years, Sue Klebold, Dylan's mother, has lived with the indescribable grief and shame of that day. How could her child, the promising young man she had loved and raised for 17 years, be responsible for such horror? And how, as his mother, had she not seen it? What, if anything, should she have done differently? It is those questions that she grapples with every day since Columbine, and to which she has written about in her new memoir, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. She breaks her silence and addresses for the first time the tragic events of that day, and chronicles her journey as an ordinary suburban mother trying to come to terms with the incomprehensible. Again, the name of the book is A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy, and we welcome Sue Klebold to the roundtable this morning. Sue, thank you very much for being with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
At what point since 1999 did it occur to you that this was something that you would want to write about and share your feelings about?
I don't think there was ever a point at which I decided to write, because I am somebody who likes to write. I've always kept journals. I was journaling about this experience from the moment it happened. And the difficult decision point was whether or not to publish, because I knew I would have to make myself available to people. I'd have to have my picture out there and have people know who I was. And that decision really evolved slowly over time as I progressed through all the phases of recovery, of feeling first like a victim and then more like a survivor, more able to try to help other people, be more active in trying to reach out and do volunteer work in the area of suicide prevention and mental health awareness, and finally really becoming an advocate in the last several years, where I felt that there was a real imperative to do this, that it was something that I had a responsibility to do.
What was the immediate reaction to you and your husband and your family following this? Because you write about this, and I'm curious about the amount of support that you did and did not get at that time.
The people who knew us and who knew Dylan, and certainly I had worked and lived in this community for many years, had many friends, and the people that we knew were very supportive of us. We didn't lose any friends over this incident. People rallied. They protected us. They would, notify us if strangers were parked on the streets. They would call us. They brought us food. They cared for us in every loving and imaginable way. But there was this real juxtaposition going on, because the outer world, people who did not know us, people who had immediately come to believe that we were negligent, wealthy, evil, whatever their perception was, there was just a real firestorm of hatred from people who needed and wanted to believe those things. So that was the two worlds that I lived in. It was this, inner circle of people who loved and protected us. And then, I turn on the radio and hear myself being called disgusting, or we'd see memorials vandalized because they would include something in memory of my son. And so those two things were occurring. But most of the outreach where people did contact me, most of it was very kind and loving, and many people identified with the loss, with having a family member who was struggling with mental health issues or who had done something to harm himself or someone else.
When it comes to those mental health issues, and you write about this in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that you are really painfully searching for those moments through these past years of looking for something that would have given you a very clear clue that there was a problem this massive.
Yes, and not only was I doing that, but everyone was doing that. When this first happened, I was completely bewildered. It took many months for me to even realize what my son had actually done, because so many individuals were harmed. He and his friend Eric killed 13 people before taking their own lives. I, at that time, knew nothing about what was on his mind, what state of mind he had been in, how he ended up there. So that process took a very long time, and certainly I was looking for answers, as everyone was in our community. So that looking for the golden key, that one thing that would explain why this happened, that was something that naturally occurs. My own son's death was a suicide. This particular tragedy falls under the category, from Dylan's perspective, as a murder-suicide. So when I began to look at Dylan's own suicidality and to look at the complexity of why and how suicide does occur and what happens to an individual's thinking and how they detach from reason and logic in the same way that we have access to those tools, it became clear to me that there were no easy answers, that this was a complex set of circumstances that occurred for something like this, that, it's one in millions that your child would take part in something like this. And it was a very, the tiniest circumstances had to overlap and be in just the wrong place at the right, the right time, vice versa, for this to occur.
It seems in reading the book that in most cases, and we just look at this through a lens of what it is like to communicate with a teenager,
yes,
that you were communicative with your son. You were able to communicate and talk to him.
Yes, and one of the things that I think people to this day still refuse to believe, because they were so imprinted with the concept that we were negligent, did not love our son, did not show him that we loved him, did not communicate with him. This is one of the things that I think people find most shocking and most difficult to accept, is that Dylan was a very beloved child in a long-term marriage. My husband worked out of the home. He was there every day. They had a snack together. We did family activities together. In all my photographs of Dylan as a child, he is, on laps. He's got arms around him. He was cuddled. So, people have to let go of this concept that if someone was raised with love, they are not capable of harming themselves or other people, because that is just a fantasy.
Do you believe it was always his goal to take his own life?
I believe that it was. We saw his writings long after his death. I was never aware that he had written, and he didn't have a journal like a diary. But what he did was he wrote on like school paper, and it would be in the notebook. I was not aware until long after his death, when the police gave copies of these materials to me, that he had been writing about his desire to die by suicide a full 2 years before the massacre. He wrote about being in extreme pain. He wrote about wanting to get a gun. He also wrote about cutting himself. In his lifetime, I never saw any evidence of that. And, of course, I was not looking for that, because I didn't see things that I thought indicated that anything was occurring like that. But I believe that he was experiencing suicidal thoughts a full 2 years before this occurred, and that over time, whatever his issues were, they got worse, and whatever his state of mind was, it reached sort of a stage 4 lethal condition, and that eventually he felt ready to end his life and take part in this massacre that his I think his friend was fantasizing strongly about. So yes, in my mind, the reason he was there was to find a means through which to end his life.
And this all comes funneling out after his death, where you not only learn of the massacre that you described, but also of the mental condition, the depression, and the fact that he was drinking at the end of his life,
right,
which was something that you and your husband were not aware of.
Right. That's correct. And even learning after his death that he had an online name that we had no idea, but, he had called himself Vodka as a nickname because it had his initials, DK, in the middle of that word. So these were things that I was not aware of. And part of the issue with Dylan was that he was one of those kids who always did everything right. He was in a gifted program. He managed his life so beautifully. He would be the one that could save money or keep his room neat or, take the tests in school that he was supposed to take and get in the top percentiles. He was just somebody that you always looked at and said, this person is managing his life. This is the person that will become a successful adult. And so he did have some changes in his junior year. He got into trouble in 11th grade, and he and Eric stole something, and he got in trouble at school and for scratching a locker. And that was a time when this was the first time we'd seen him act out or do anything that was going to get him into trouble. And I was very concerned, and he ended up getting into a diversion program, and I wondered, if he needed therapy or not. But everybody who knew Dylan, we all assured ourselves, this is a great kid, he'll do fine. And I talked with him and talked about therapy, and he said, I'll prove to you, I don't need therapy. I'm going to get my life on track. And then for the next 14 months of his life, up until the moment he died, he did get his life on track, and the behaviors he displayed were, for the most part, very positive and normal. He had times when he was sullen and crabby, but he also hung out with the family and with friends and did fun things, went to a prom 3 days before he died. So it's very difficult to identify when teens are having problems, and one of the things we need to look for is a change in behavior. And I believe that in 11th grade, if I had recognized his getting into trouble as a dramatic change in behavior, that he should have had counseling and we should have gotten him some help.
Sue Klebold is our guest. The name of the book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. You make the point in the book to use the terms brain illness and brain health as opposed to mental illness and mental health. Why is that an important distinction?
I got that suggestion from one of the experts we interviewed for the book. Mental health has a lot of preconceived notion attached to it. It has a lot of years and years of stigma. And it's kind of an intangible term. It's very hard for us as human beings to conceptualize what mental health is or what mental illness is. And this individual suggested that we begin to talk about the issue of brain health or brain illness. We know from a lot of research that people who are experiencing suicidal thoughts have differences in their brains from people who are healthy. There is research being done now to look at, serotonin levels and receptors and different activity in the frontal lobe. There's been a study on how saliva changes with certain kinds of depression. So this really is a medical issue. It is not a character issue. It is something that is malfunctioning. And if we view certain kinds of behaviors and thought patterns as being a brain illness, I think it helps people sort of put this into a medical realm rather than into a character realm.
And you also point out that it was important for you and a turning point that once you labeled this and understood that suicide was at the core of this, it helped you in a way to understand a little bit more.
It certainly did. Dylan's death in a murder-suicide, grasping what happened in that framework, very much helped me begin to understand and sort of untangle all of the things I was dealing with. You know, I had believed, you know, that he didn't love us or else he couldn't have done this, or, you know, how does someone get to a place where all the things you've ever taught them are ignored? And in speaking with other individuals who had made suicide attempts, in reading about suicide and what happens to the mind when one is deeply into a progression of suicidal thinking, it really helped me understand that Dylan was a victim of his own thinking, of his own pathology, and, you know, that I didn't quite see him the same as a perpetrator, as someone like you or me who would just suddenly decide to do this horribly cruel and evil thing. I really began to perceive that he was a victim of his own malfunction, that he had lost his access to tools that would help him govern his behavior and access conscience, and that those things were not available to him because of what was going on in his thinking.
As part of the thinking, and you write about this as well, that a year, a little bit over a year, prior to the tragedy, that Dylan was talking to your husband about frustration with kids at school who, quote, were really asking for it.
Right.
And that became very instrumental into the understanding of this, that the people, that there were targets in this.
Well, actually, that's questionable. In this shooting, as in almost all others, very rarely are people targeted in these shootings. Very often it's a random act, and it's not common for people to target certain individuals and actually kill them. Sometimes shooters have someone in mind as a target, but they end up killing others instead. I don't know if Dylan had anyone in particular in mind. He certainly did not harm anyone or kill anyone that we were aware had, you know, hurt him in any way. I believe that he had generalized a sense of rage. I believe that he and Eric had experienced certainly one incident that was recalled in the book about them being bullied and shoved around and insulted and squirting ketchup on them, and certainly the climate of the school was such that it was very common for kids to be treated unkindly, garbage thrown at them or being knocked down in the hallways. That was common and certainly reported. So, you know, I think that the culture was pretty toxic. And if you put it through a filter of a depressed individual who's struggling and get that bullying environment in there, it can be a very dangerous thing. And in many cases, it leads to suicide. In Dylan and Eric's case, it led to a mass murder.
Sue Klebold is our guest. The name of the book is A Mother's Reckoning. It is published by Crown. Let us talk for a moment about the relationship with Eric Harris, because there are two involved in this shooting, in this murder-suicide. Talk a little bit about the relationship, and I assume that there is a tendency at the very beginning to say, well, he fell into a bad crowd.
Right. I have spoken with some of the experts in this book about this lethal pairing of these two individuals. I think the general consensus is that Eric was a psychopath, that he was experiencing psychopathy, that he was at an age where it was beginning to surface. Eric's manifestation of that was tremendous rage outwardly, And I believe that, you know, Eric's desire was to kill primarily, and that was his reason for being there, and he was willing to die to accomplish that. I believe that Dylan's desire was to die, and he was willing to kill to accomplish that. The juxtaposition of someone who with psychopathy and someone with depression can be a lethal combination. This is not the only school shooting involving two people with this type of relationship and with these types of pathologies. So there was some kind of a bonding, I think, that made both of them interdependent. They fed off of each other. It was a very strong and compelling relationship for them. Certainly it was a deadly one.
Were you concerned at all about the relationship prior to the tragedy?
I was only concerned about 14 months before the tragedy when the two of them together stole something. They stole some electronic equipment from a van that was parked on a country road, and they were arrested. And at that time, we were concerned and wanted to separate the two boys, wanted to make sure that they didn't spend so much time together. Of course, they saw each other at school. We had no control over that. But, you know, as parents, we felt that this relationship was not in his best interest, so we did what we could to limit his exposure to this friend. And over time, as Dylan demonstrated to us that he was running his life effectively and making good choices and working and being in school plays and going to school and applying to colleges, over time, you know, we softened that requirement, and the two of them did spend time together. But from our view, they were not as close as they apparently had become. We thought that Eric was just one of Dylan's friends. He had quite a few friends. And from what we could see, he didn't ask Eric to come over to the house. We had no idea that there was a very close and secretive bond going on between the two of them.
How would you characterize the relationship with Eric's parents now, given that these are probably the only two people on the planet that can have any sense and commonality in what you're going through?
I do occasionally stay in touch with the Harrises. What people have to understand about tragedies such as this, when you have a family member who has done such a horrible, horrible thing, it is very, very difficult for the family on so many levels. Of course, you have grief for the loss of your own loved one. There's a tremendous amount of humiliation and fear and all kinds of trauma around media exposure, being judged, being hated. So I have met quite a few families, parents of people who have committed crimes such as this. They really want to be left alone. They want privacy. They don't want to be constantly reminded of this. So it's a very difficult thing. Very often, I believe that the Harrises are criticized for not coming forward, and I think that is that's unreasonable. I think that people have to respect the privacy of individuals whose families have done this, because they don't understand how it happened or why it happened. They were being the best parents they knew how to be. They were getting care for their son. They had him in counseling. The experts who worked with him had no inkling that these things were going on in his mind.
When you look at your life now, all these years later, this happened almost 17 years ago. Everything has changed. You have lost your son. Your marriage of 43 years dissolves. You now are put into a role almost as an advocate for those who have gone through shockingly similar cases. So where do you find that will and a new path in life that keeps you going with one foot in front of the other?
I'm the kind of person who has always been, I think, contented inside. And I've always been a person who feels a lot of gratitude for life. And that's just who I am. That's just my personality. So when all these terrible things happened and I had this long and difficult journey, people reached out to help me along the way. And I was so grateful for their love and for their help. And now that I'm a little stronger and a little further down the line, it is my privilege to be able to help others who have difficult losses and to let them know that, you know, life can continue, that life will never be the same as it was. But there are many blessings in life, the opportunity to help others, the opportunity to have a cause that you believe in and can work toward, to give your time, your money, the book proceeds, whatever it is.
Right.
That these are gifts that life gives you. The opportunity to give to others is one of the greatest gifts we ever receive. So that's sort of the way I think about it.
It is important to note, and I assume it's important for you, for people to know that you are not benefiting financially
right.
from the book.
Yes. I am donating all of my share of the profits to mental health and suicide prevention organizations.
When it comes to the issue of guns and mass shootings, mm-hmm. of course, what happened at Columbine High School is referenced constantly. That becomes a part of your conversation as well. I'm interested in your thoughts as we as a nation deal with these tragedies, and you see the frustration of the President of the United States day after day having to comment and deal with this. I'm curious to your frustration and your thoughts.
I believe that at times in our lives, many of us are very vulnerable. And I will look at the example of just suicidality in particular, because that is the tunnel through which I've sort of come into this awareness and understanding. People who are at risk of harming themselves are actually one of the, they are, certainly in my state, 76% of deaths by firearms are suicides. So the way I have approached this thought is, you know, how dangerous it is for guns to be easily accessed by people who are vulnerable. And that is the key thing here is, how do we determine vulnerability? How do we know at any one time if someone in someone's life, if they are going through a period when they are at high risk, at risk of hurting themselves, risk of hurting others? And that seems to be the real challenge here. We don't have enough good ways to try to help people when they need it so that these things don't escalate into mass shootings.
You were not a gun household. This is not a gun family.
No, we were not. You know, that's one of these ironies in this thing was that people often wonder why, you know, how I didn't know there was a gun in my house. Well, I didn't even think to look. If you're not a gun-owning family and you don't have them in your home, why would I look for that? I mean, I had no idea that my son, my 17-year-old son, had purchased a gun or would be able to purchase a gun and that it would be hidden somewhere on our premises. It wasn't the run-of-the-mill thing that I even had on my mind. It wasn't something that I even thought I needed to look for.
One of the things that you write about toward the end of the book, which I think is so important, is you write, when tragedies like Columbine or Virginia Tech or Sandy Hook happen, the first question everyone asks is why. Perhaps this is the wrong question. I have come to believe the better question is how. My question to you is, how did you come to make that distinction, and then why is that such an important distinction to make?
After the tragedy happened, you know, the big question was why. And I think when we ask the question why, we tend to look for simple, easy solutions. We tend to look for blame. We tend to say, oh, this happened because they were bad parents. This happened because of bullying. This happened because of video games. And that what that does is it leads us into dead ends. it's not actionable. I believe that the process, that there is a process involved where someone takes part in a shooting such as this. It is not a simple, you know, one cause factor. It is a combination of many things. If we look at shootings such as this, I like to apply a medical model to it, the same way we look at heart disease or diabetes, that if someone is vulnerable to suicide, suicide alone without violence, and violence is another component that we definitely need to study more, but if we're just talking about suicidality, someone who dies by suicide gets to that place because of biological and genetic factors, because of environmental factors that may include the home as well as the school or the workplace or the culture. It has to do with personality. This is true of heart disease as well. And it also includes triggering factors or circumstances that might have made this person's life experience more painful. It's not just one thing. It is a combination of things working together. And I think only through exploring the process of how these things work together are we going to find answers that work.
When it comes to the ultimate takeaway from the book, Andrew Solomon, who writes the introduction, says, "The ultimate message of this book is terrifying. You may not know your own children, and worse yet, your children may be unknowable to you. The stranger you fear may be your own son or daughter." What do you want the takeaway to be for parents and just for readers to understand?
If we're going to tackle some of these societal problems, such as the major health issue of suicide and violence toward others, I think the first place we need to start is how we communicate with people we love, especially people who are troubled or in pain. We have to accept the fact that even though things may seem normal, they may not be. That an individual who is experiencing deterioration in their thinking most often and very often hide this. They don't want it to show. They don't want people to know. So the first thing I would say is, you know, look beyond what you see. Don't necessarily trust what you see. Don't make the assumption that when things are okay, maybe a little bit grouchy, maybe a little bit weepy, consider the idea that somebody might really be struggling, and this might be an indication that a serious health condition is occurring that may be lethal. The other thing, from a communications perspective, as a parent, I often try to, when I listen to my children and certainly when my parents listen to me, we want to make them feel better. For example, if I would go to my mom when I was growing up and say, "I'm ugly, nobody likes me," my mother would come back and say, "But you're beautiful, but I love you." And in responding that way, that has a way of sort of trying to talk someone out of what they're feeling, to sort of discount their feelings. And I think we need to do a much better job of asking open-ended questions, asking kids, do they feel so bad that they want to die? And are you thinking about suicide? And then if they are willing to reveal that to us, and some will be and some will lie, then we have to be absolutely certain that we have access to good care. And we each have a responsibility to insist that our physicians are well-trained, our schools are capable of assessing and helping kids, our law enforcement systems are aware of the high risk that people experience when they've gone through an arrest or some humiliating experience. So those would be the action things that I would want people to begin with.
The one thing I do want to mention also is that, of course, Dylan had an older brother.
Yes.
And not only are you and your husband going through this in the days, weeks, and years following, but of course your son, and you have to go through all of this and still be a parent to him as well, when I assume, as you write, your parenting is very much in question, and you have questions about what is going on.
Yes, and certainly that was true immediately after the shootings, because my older son was a younger man then, and I was very, very concerned, you know, for his mental state and his safety, and that is very common after a suicide loss. Family members, they worry about each other. You think, well, we lost this person, will I lose someone else? Now my younger son is an adult, and we are very close and have wonderful talks, and you know, time goes by, and we all cope with this in any way that we can, and we've all done that. We've all tried in our own way to process this loss and this tragedy and to go on and live meaningful lives.
As I mentioned, it's been 17 years. As you've been on this book tour and you're talking, are there still moments where you close your eyes and can't believe that it's you talking about your son?
All the time. That happens all the time.
Yeah.
I look at my quiet little ordinary life, my sort of Eleanor Roosevelt years upbringing and everything, you know, trying to do everything well and right and according to the book, and to find that I am someone in this place is astounding to me. It continues to amaze me every day.
Sue Klebold is the author of the book A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. I thank you so much for sharing with us. I thank you so much for your attempt to put your thumb on the incomprehensible and giving that a voice and sharing it with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Joe, for the opportunity.
Sue Klebold is the author of the book A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. The book is published by Crown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.